You're listening to Simpler One Earth Living from Jubilee One Earth Economics and Simple Living Works with co-hosts Lee Van Ham and Jerry Iverson. Today we feature a conversation with Michael Patrick White Eagle O'Connor, Native American artist and earth activist.
In this podcast and the next, we interview two different Native Americans from the Siouxland region of the U.S. Now, I'm excited about this, and I'll tell you why. As Michael Patrick White Eagle O'Connor says in this interview, we are in the seventh generation, and that's according to a prophecy of Black Elk and other Native American holy people. The seventh generation is the time of healing, and that means, among other things, that it's a time when genuine partnerships develop among non-Indigenous and Indigenous peoples. These two interviews push aside any residual thoughts in our minds that Indigenous peoples are peoples of the past or are fading into the past. No, that's something we must correct if there's any residual thoughts like that in our mind. The spiritual activism and the perspectives of traditional Indigenous peoples are leading the way for the one earth living we espouse on our podcasts. So do stay with us. This is an important opportunity to hear a 48-year-old social worker and Native American in the Sioux City region of Iowa, and he's going to speak to how he follows his spiritual path in addressing the issues of today.
Greetings, Lee, from Paso Robles, California, and Simple Living Works.
And not too long ago from Sioux City, Iowa, right? Well, I greet you, Jerry, from San Diego and Jubilee One Earth Economics. And I'm really glad, as you can tell from what I've already said, Jerry, that you met with Patrick Michael White Eagle O'Connor and had the conversation that we're sharing with listeners in this podcast. So he speaks so transparently about himself and his struggle to be on his spiritual path, his deep relationship with the energy of Earth, his work with Native American youth, his readiness for partnership with non-Indigenous people who seek it authentically. Well, I've been on this journey of seeking it authentically for some time, and especially when I wrote my book, From Egos to Eden. A Indigenous woman, Patricia... Oh, goodness, St. Ange, Patricia St. Ange, who's Haudenosaunee, helped me enormously in recasting a whole chapter I have on Native Americans and how we need to partner with them. When she first read my manuscript, she said, "Well, Lee, you write as if we are people of the past, and you write like a white person who is writing about us. You no longer let us speak in our own voices." And that was just some of what she told me. So I'm paging through my book here, so if you hear some pages rattling, that's why. I want to just read one paragraph from it. This is my book, From Egos to Eden, and it has a lot more to say about our topic today than what I can share here. So, I hope you'll buy a copy and read it, From Egos to Eden. So I say here, writing this chapter, and this is chapter 7 in the book, comes at a time in my own journey when I am coming into the consciousness that sees First Peoples and hears them in their own voices. Most of my life, I've, quote, known, end quote, First Peoples, only in the voices of others writing about them. Patricia St. Ange, author of the foreword, is a guide to me in making this important shift. She showed me how in an earlier manuscript she felt talked about, but wasn't really there, and how important it is to speak of First Peoples in the present, not only the past, and of their struggles, and of their participation in the struggles of now. Well, she changed the tone and tense of this whole book. So I just share that by way of some of my personal journey of seeking to move into being one who has some capacities and readiness to partner with indigenous peoples who are so ready to help guide us into One Earth Living and partner with us in that. And then I also want to say one more thing, Jerry, here before we move to the conversation you had with our guest. You know, just in the last couple of days, the governor of California has apologized to the state's Native Americans. They met under a big tree. The New York Times and other places reports this. An assemblyman in James Ramos in the California State Assembly helped arrange this meeting. And it was in 1851 when California's first governor, Peter Burnett, told the legislature to expect war, quote, until the Indian race becomes extinct, end quote. And from there, Governor Newsom went on to just talk about the dark history in California and issued an apology in front of a group of Native Americans. It was an emotional presentation and just recited some awfully dark stuff. And then he said, it's called genocide. That's what it was, a genocide. No other way to describe it. And that's the way it needs to be described in the history books. So our podcast today is very much very timely given what's happened here in our state. Deborah Haaland, may recognize her name as the New Mexico Congresswoman, says, "Well, anything we can do to right past wrong." She's commenting on Newsom's statement. She says she thinks that's meaningful. This country was founded on genocide. For California, it was a lot worse because it happened so much later than it did for the rest of the country. So the tribal leaders welcome Mr. Newsom's gesture, and of course they go on from there to say, but if it doesn't mean that there's next actions for funding programs of education and other social needs within the community, then well, then I guess it's mostly words. just wanted to add that into our podcast today, Jerry, as we move into our interview. So take us into that.
So, Michael, you're an activist and an artist and a representative of your Native American tribe. So I would like to hear your story. Sure. You know, what you're busy doing for the care of the earth and how you express that care through your art and your activism.
Okay. Well, Jerry, do you want me to hold that? Okay, well, Jerry, I don't know if I would consider myself an artist as far as the general term of what is viewed as art. I mean, I like to do things, dream catchers. I've dabbled in a little bit of painting. I love to paint rocks. Let's just say I've done a lot of different things, carvings, wood carvings. My latest project would be carving with a buffalo bone. I have a couple of big old buffalo bones literally out in my car right now that I'm interested in exploring that as an avenue of expression, as an avenue of reconnecting with my ancestors and the power that comes from those type of things. But I went to a tribal university, Sinte Gleska University, but I also went to Ihonktawan Community College in Marty, South Dakota, just a tiny reservation community college. And one of my professors there, he had said that we all have that inner capacity to be artists. We are literally art in motion, and it's just a matter of knowing that. And when we know that, it deepens. It's kind of deep. As far as I'm concerned, it deepens our awareness, and we are able to sort of, I would say, probably get to know ourselves better. And so when you say artists, I refer to that as opposed to canvas on the wall, etc. As now, you mentioned something else as far as activism, or
yes, how you express your Native American spirituality through your activism and care for the earth.
That's a good one. You know, my Native American spirituality is innate. It's in my blood. It's in my heart. The first thing that I have to do as far as that goes is I have to sort of shed that habituated thought system that goes along with my 9-to-5. I'm a social worker with Iowa DHS, and all the stress that goes along with the 9-to-5, with the stress of the job, with the stress of everything that falls underneath the job. And God knows, I mean, I'm grateful that to be doing what I'm doing. I mean, I feel like this is what I was meant to do. So I feel very fortunate. But along the lines, as far as my Native spirituality, it's very necessary for me to sort of make sure that it takes effort to sort of plug into that consciousness of who I am as a Native person. And so that means becoming very fundamental in thought and releasing, shedding the stressors of the modern day of, you know, answering your cell phone, of being on time, and the stressors of making status quo. And so that's one of the things that I feel that is necessary, that is difficult. It was difficult for me initially. But then I learned that it wasn't so much about releasing. It was more about sort of allowing my spirit to rise to the surface, and then and that took a while to get to know myself on that sort of, on that level, for lack of a better word, on that basis. And I've gotten better and better at it at a time, but it's just so innate. But the stressors of this world and how you look and when saying the right thing sort of can prevent me, create a barrier from that natural spirit, expression of spirit. And so as far as activism goes, the first thing that I do is make sure that I'm being who Creator put me on this earth to be. And that's in Hongtuan. It's a Native man. It's a Native American man. And so when I do that, I then enter sort of, that opens up the doorway, I would say, the spiritual doorway of expression. True, deepest, highest. I know those are contradictory, but deepest, highest, however you see it, however you think, deepest, highest expression of soul, of spirit. And I know that I was put here for a reason. I don't think that just Creator put me here just on a whim, just to be funny. I think that I was put here for a purpose, and I really suffered a lot as it up until this point to just come to the realization that I am who Creator made me. And so that's the very fundamental of shedding and allowing that to sort of surface and to release the infatuation with this modern day world. And of course, there's balance. There has to be balance. But myself, I find it, when we talk about being an artist, I find it very artistically sort of innate. I keep on saying that word, but it's for lack of a better word. I just find it that it's that when I'm able to do that, and then I'm able to open up that avenue for what I feel through trial and error, doesn't make me perfect, I'll always make mistakes, to then be a venue or an avenue, not only for my own expression of who I am as a Native person, as a spirit, as a brother, as a uncle, as a lot of things, but then that opens that doorway to that depth that lies behind this world that we see, that is very much the unseen. And so that is the fundamental as far as activism goes. But as now we're as far as that initial process, and but when you plug, when I plug into that consciousness, that sort of a plane of consciousness that exists out here in this, out here in the flow, then I become very aware of what my responsibility is as a Native man, and that's when we go into what is referred to activism. And so, you know, there we don't have any modern day. We can't. Times have changed. Times have changed. And so, the warrior type persona, the warrior types, has also changed. And so, that's when we talk about activism. Is that's what I refer to as like Native American social issues. And so, there are a lot, particularly in our area. Woodbury County holds the highest number of Native American population in the state of Iowa. And the last count, I had heard a statistic just the other day that there are 29 tribes residing in our area. That could be give or take. It wouldn't surprise me if there was 50, actually, because I've just ran across a lot of different types of people. And so I take from an Ahangtuan, a Yankton Sioux type of representation. And I'm really interested and curious about my life. I've been very active for a number of years, and I'm really fascinated that where this path will take me. And I just don't have any doubt that I am on the right path. But it's hard. It's a hard road. It's very challenging. Here I am today. So does that answer your question?
Indeed. And just a little geography lesson for our listeners, that when you say Yankton Sioux, Yankton is a town in South Dakota.
Sure.
And the Sioux tribe, of course, is an important tribe in the region.
We'll return momentarily to our conversation with Native American artist and activist Patrick Michael White Eagle O'Connor. We want you to know that One Earth Jubilee has taken another step to help us all counter the carbon dioxide we put into the air as we drive our cars, fly away to places, heat or cool our homes, and all the other ways in our lives that we release CO2 into the atmosphere. So we can offset these. And this is a new habit I'm trying to develop in my own life. For me, it's an act of certainly discipleship and stewardship, and that is to offset my use that puts CO2 into the air by sequestering CO2 out of the air through the planting of trees. So what we urge you to do is to calculate your carbon with the carbon calculator, which is online. It's at carbonify.com, and then when you when it tells you how many dollars it would take to plant some trees, you can donate that amount to Jubilee Economics Tree Fund, or just actually Jubilee Economics, and in the memo line say Tree Fund, and then the two Jubilee circles in Mexico and the one in San Diego, who are all working with trusted partners in planting trees, will be able to use your donation in that way. And it's a good step for all of us, even though it's not any final solution. It helps, certainly makes a move toward carbon sequestration, and it's an action we can all take. So now let's return to our conversation that Jerry has had.
Can you give me a handful of your top priorities when it comes to social issues?
Well, oh man, there's you know, obviously some of my top priorities in this area would be the youth. Because our children are already high risk just entering this world as Native American people. And by that, I mean we have the highest risks of suicide. We have if you're born into this world Native, you're more than likely going to be growing up in poverty. You're more than likely going to be growing up in, you're going to be 100% affected by alcoholism and drug addiction, because by that I mean that the indigenous people like us, we have an entirely different viewpoint on what constitutes what the definition of relatives are. So I don't know if we have time to go into that, but certainly some of the things that I'm very active in is with our youth, with those with addictions, with alcoholism, with social issues, and how our people are being served in our native, in our community. For crying out loud, the town is called Sioux City. We live in Sioux land, and so there's all these things that were named after the lands, but yet our people, and I'm finding out the more I go along, that are increasingly falling in between the cracks, because our people need to have a voice, and we don't. We don't have voices in this communities. A lot of our people either can't vote or not interested in voting because there lacks a trust with the non-native world, and quite frankly, we have a different value system as well. And we are, and so when we start talking about politics, there is just an understanding that just says, a belief system that says nobody cares about the Native people, so we're not going to care about them. We're busy raising our families. We're busy trying to, when you're Native, it's about surviving in this world. Because I always say this, the Native American in this community and probably throughout is hostage to people's moods. And by that, I mean how I'm treated when I go to the doctor, or when during a car accident and the police respond, or the nurses, or even the register at the come and go gas station. We are hostage to whether or not that police officer has had his morning coffee, or that doctor is working a 24-hour shift, or that nurse has had enough rest, or is going through a divorce, or et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. We are held hostage to people's moods because of who we are. And there exists common, and I've asked people over and over again, and people very bravely were honest, they associate Native Americans with negative stereotypes, that we're a bunch of drunks, that we're lazy. And so when they see a Native person, we get held hostage to that belief. And then whether or not that person, whatever they're going through in their life, is in a good mood or a bad mood, whether or not I'm going to be followed around in the store. I mean, I just can't tell you how many times I've been mistreated just for walking down the street and being who I am. You know, for those of you that don't, that are listening, I have very long hair that I'm proud of. I grow for spiritual reasons, and I fit the stereotype of your typical Native American person, is that I have dark skin. I keep to myself quite a bit. I'm very sort of observational, and And that makes me a target, like I said, and so for moods, for just, I mean, I've had people down by, I had a couple of incidents in the last couple of years where one guy said, go back to my teepee. And then one guy, this is just a very sad story, but he was an elder gentleman, and I like to read outside of the library and take my shoes off and just be down there because I just love to be down there. And I saw this older gentleman, and I mean older, I don't mean any disrespect, but he had to have been at least 80 years old, and it looked like he was struggling to cross the street over where I was, and that was on 6th Street, around 6th and Pier Street in Sioux City. That's a very busy street. And the first thing that popped into my mind was, oh, hold on, I got to go help this gentleman out. You know, he's an old elder gentleman and he needs my help. And so I was watching him. I couldn't take my eyes off him. And so finally I saw that he was very capable of crossing the street. And so I went back to my book. And then all of a sudden, as he's crossing the street, he comes over towards my side and he starts yelling, Hitler was a good man. Kill them all. They should all die. And I'm thinking, my God, it, obviously very shocked. And so he stopped, and then I commenced to going back into my book. Well, two, three seconds later, he's literally inches from my head, and I look up and because he starts yelling it. Only this time he's directing it at me. And he says the same thing, kill you all, Hitler was a good man. And something along those lines, but almost verbatim, that's what he was saying. And so to me, that is just a very strong indication. I mean, that's an extreme example, I know that. But having grown up Native American all my life, it stings. It stings that I can't just go into a store and shop like anybody else, and that I get followed. It stings that people not only see me that way, but treat my older brother, whom I love the most, you know, depending on whether or not. It's almost like we always have to sort of be on edge. And in fact, in this community, it's sort of the extraordinary, it's the exception when somebody actually says, tell me more. Mm-hmm. Because I attend a lot of community events and I speak a lot. I speak in high schools. I've spoken at college. I've spoken in front of community events. Now I'm speaking to you, the audience, and I thank you for that. But nobody ever stops to ask or says, tell me more about that. Mm-hmm. And to me, that's the exception. I probably wouldn't even know how to act if somebody actually said, I want to know more about the issues. Mm-hmm. And if you're Native, you see these issues every day, and we have to confront these issues. And if when we do, we have to go about it in a way that it's almost like we have to behave all the time. People seem to have been given the permission to mistreat us, to look down upon us, depending on their mood. But when we show that we're not going to, that we're tired of it, or that we're not going to take it, or that we just plain don't like it, I'm just sitting around reading a book, for crying out loud. And then if we show that, nobody ever just says, tell me more. Mm-hmm. And I don't understand that. I don't. It's when you say activism, it's almost like, okay, what's the next thing that's going to pop up in our community? You know, because I know it's going to. And so I engage law enforcement quite a bit. I engage all these resources in our community about every day. And I engage our own Native people. I volunteer my time to go over to the treatment centers and teach them about some of our very simple ceremonies that will help them in their life. And I just got done doing that before I practiced a very simple ceremony. It's called the Zedia ceremony, but in slang term, it's called smudge. And that's just using some sage to cleanse my consciousness and have a prayer. And unfortunately, sometimes sage can be confused or it smells similar to marijuana. So I even doing that every morning when I get in the elevator at the DHS building, because I smudge my hair down, I make sure I become immersed in the smell. That now I gotta wonder, just practicing it, that somebody's gonna accuse me of smoking marijuana. But you know, hey, I'll take it, because you know that would be an opportunity to educate somebody. And so I do a lot of educating. I do cultural competency. I've done that at several of the areas and around this area, community college, university level, et cetera. So over the years, activism has been something that has, it's a responsibility. I'm 48 years old, and I'm going to be one of the next elders. And so I right now am fulfilling my role as in someday my role will be an elder. And so the elders before me pass the spiritual baton to me. And so that's what I'm doing, is fulfilling what I'm supposed to be doing. And that there is no punching in time clock. There's no 9 to 5. This is a 24-hour thing, because everywhere I go, I'm a Native American, and I know that I'm fighting stereotypes just by walking down the street, just by showing up. The burden of representation is what they call it in the equity language. And so I know that. So I know wherever I go, I want people to see a Native American man that is not going to stand, not only just not going to stand for that, but be very vocal about it, but at the same time practice some of our value system that says, well, let's have a conversation. So people don't really want to have a conversation with me, so I just sort of balance that out by allowing my asking people if they would like to have a conversation. Because in me resides a lot of information that is thousands of years old. And with that information comes power and comes in a responsibility. And some of our values include being brave. Some of our values, the top values, include being humble. Now, in the European Western world, humility isn't one of our top values. It could be seen as a weakness. Hey, this guy doesn't say much. He's quiet. He must be weak. When in fact, this person is probably a very humble, observational, very patient person. That could be misconstrued as be a weakness. In our modern day Western world, it's talk, 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 talk. Right here, right now, move, move, move. So, you get what I mean. Mm. So, I hope that answers your question.
Beautiful. Thank you, Michael. Well, I would like to hear more.
Sure.
And I need to just help people identify with what you're talking about. You're talking about a lot of personal issues, a lot of cultural issues. Mm-hmm. Probably most people in the United States have heard about the water warriors that have protested pollution of rivers by oil pipelines and that kind of thing.
Sure.
So you might want to comment on that, but most of what you said is on a more personal, cultural level than the macro political level.
Sure. For the fact that the water protectors are being taken seriously, to me, just is an indicator of what I've been talking about in the first place. water is life movement is something that sort of has ignited our warriors, has ignited that DNA, has ignited who we are as a people. And so it, so yes, the U.S. government has violated time and time again, almost at their own convenience. And because we're not voters and because we don't have political leverage, in that I mean money, most American tribes are going to be poor. So we don't have that. And so the fact that society kind of has these stereotypes, they were viewed as somewhat of a, non-existent. And so the water is life, water protector movement has ignited the warrior mentality that is, goes back thousands of years. And to me, this is an energy system, and by that I mean that energy is already in our earth. There are so many ways I could go with this conversation. And so the grandmother earth, Unchi Makaw, has been crying out, particularly to us, everybody, but particularly since we have such a awareness and relationship with creation, when all of a sudden this water protector movement came to be, the relationship between creation and the indigenous people all of a sudden created an energy. And so that has been like a blessing in disguise, because now we have more people that are becoming more and more about the responsibilities. It just isn't just about water. There are so many social issues that exist. Myself, I've been fighting the battle as far as being on the front lines. At that time, I was working. I was in court a lot. And so at that time, I had said, oh, good, I'm going to let them, my relatives do that. I'm going to let them do that. And I'm going to encourage them. And I'd have friends that would come back and we'd pray with them and we would counsel. We would get together and we would talk. And then they would go back up. Myself, I stayed here and I was thinking, you know, I've been fighting these social issues. We have so many social issues. I've been fighting these. And now I hate to say this, but if my attitude was kind of like, they're ignited. Our youth are ignited. They're up there. I'm going to let them have this one. I'm going to let, they got this. And so because of my schedule, especially having to be in court a lot, I decided just to stay home and support them. And we prayed for them a lot. There was a lot of us community members that prayed a lot for them. We would send up support because a lot of community members around here, like I said, went there and then they found their identity. And so now they're back here. They're still in the communities. They're still fighting for the water, but they've also sort of spread their wings to other social causes. And that's what I thought should happen. And that's what I loved about it. And so I was never up in Standing Rock. I, now looking back on it, I wish I would have went up there, but I put myself on the front lines for a number of years now with all these other social issues, and I just chose to stay home and pray. And there were some of us that did make that choice, but we are very much in spirit praying and ready to go if needed. So,
thank you, Michael. Any closing thoughts?
Oh, you know, that's a pretty broad range. There's just a lot of things to talk about. You know, we're in the seventh generation. It was one of our most well-known holy men, Black Elk. who prophesied that it would be the seventh generation, in this time of the seventh generation, that a great healing would take place. And so we are in that seventh generation. And so my particular, I hate to use the word role, but I'll just use that, my particular position is I feel like I'm right where I'm supposed to be, considering what has been prophesied, not only by Blackout, but by other spiritual leaders, is that we are in a time of healing because people are listening more. People are curious. People want to know. People are starting to sort of identify a yearning for something deeper, a deeper awareness, a deeper consciousness, spirituality, if you will, and something that we can all connect on, and that is that depth of awareness that transcends what we see. Well, that changes, quite honestly, it changes how we see, it changes how we hear, it changes our perception, and we become very much like creation. As a matter of fact, we become creation. And so, I mean, I love to talk about things like that, and so maybe we can talk about it at another time, but again, like I said, it's a very powerful energy. And that's what we're seeing throughout. And so I'm glad that our area, our country, has become ignited, because now we feel the power, and now we're able to receive vision. We're able to receive vision.
You've been listening to the second half of our conversation with Michael O'Connor. In a future episode, we'll talk with Lori Payer, leader of the Strong Women of the Four Directions. Now, have you listened to our other recent episodes? In March, we talked to Chuck Collins from the Institute of Policy Studies about how inequality hurts everybody. In April, Pat Trahan talked about leaving suburban isolation for urban diversity and leaving Wall Street to invest in his own neighborhood. Exciting, exciting stories in both of those. In May, we heard from Stephen Cornett, a regenerative farmer, about that very important innovation in farming, which sequesters carbon. And in June, we talked to Carrie Radloff, Sierra Club activist in Iowa. So do listen to these. You're sure to pick up thoughts you'll value. We certainly did as we created those episodes. And then, too, subscribe to Jerry's Simpler Living Daily Nudge to get quick reminders of our blogs, our podcast episodes, and other intriguing happenings and events, such as Nonconform Freely celebrations and ways to honor rites of passage and holidays without consumerism.
Please tell us your thoughts on these subjects. Leave a message on Jubilee One Earth Economics and Simple Living Works Facebook pages. Well, it's time to wrap up this episode. You can subscribe to this podcast under the names The Common Good Podcast and Simple Living Works at your favorite podcast service. Urge your friends to do the same. Until next time, this is Jerry Iverson of Simple Living Works with co-host Lee Van Ham of Jubilee One Earth Economics, wishing you well as we strive together to bring simpler One Earth living into being for the common good. Simply live, learn to live simply so others can live.